Almighty Father, my God in heaven, we ask your compassion upon us today. Bless our studies, bless our words, bless our understanding. We observe and learn. Follow your word. Follow the truth. You speak truth and you've given us truth. And when we find it, God, help us to glorify and magnify you. We ask this blessing upon today as we keep our hearts and eyes and ears open. We praise you, Son Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen. We are reading 2 Samuel chapter 19. However, most of your English Bibles, the chapter 19 starts a little bit too late, so chapter 18, verse 33, with a proper place to begin. So we're starting from your chapter 18, verse 33, all the way through the chapter 19.
2 Samuel 18, verse 33. Then the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said thus, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place. O Absalom, my son, my son. And Joab was told, Behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. So the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people heard it and said that day, The king is grieved for his son. And the people stole back into the city that day as people who are ashamed steal away when they flee in battle. But the king covered his face and cried out with a loud voice, O my son Absalom! O Absalom, my son, my son! Then Joab came into the house to the king and said, Today you have disgraced all your servants who today have saved your life, the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives, and the lives of your concubines, in that you love your enemies and hate your friends. For you have declared today that you regard neither princes nor servants. For today I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all of us had died today, then it would have pleased you well. Now therefore, arise, go out, and speak comfort to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, no one will stay with you this night. And that will be worse for you than all the evil that has befallen you from your youth until now. Then the king arose and sat in the gate. And they told all the people, saying, There is the king sitting in the gate. So all the people came before the king, for everyone of Israel had fled to his tent. Now all the people were in a dispute throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, The king saved us from the hand of our enemies. He delivered us from the hand of the Philistines, and now he has fled from the land because of Absalom. But Absalom, whom we anointed over us, has died in battle. Now therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing back the king? So King David sent to Zadok and Abiathar and the priests, saying, Speak to the elders of Judah, saying, Why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, since the words of all Israel have come to the king, to this very house? You are my brethren, you are my bone and my flesh. Why then are you the last to bring back the king? And say to Amasa, Are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so to me, and more also, if you are not commander of the army before me continually in the place of Joab. So he swayed the hearts of all the men of Judah, just as the heart of one man, so that they sent this word to the king, Return you and all your servants. Then the king returned and came to the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal to go to meet the king, to escort the king across the Jordan. And Shimei said to the son of Gera, a Benjamite, who was with Bahurim, hurried and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. There were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and his 20 servants with him, and they went over the Jordan before the king. Then a ferry boat went across to carry over the king's household and to do what he thought good. Now Shimei the son of Gera fell down before the king when he had crossed the Jordan. Then he said to the king, "Do not let my lord impute iniquity to me, or remember what wrong your servant did on the day that my lord the king left Jerusalem, that the king should take it to heart. For I, your servant, know that I have sinned. Therefore, here I am, the first to come today of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet my lord the king." But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered and said, Shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed? And David said, "What have I to do with you, the sons of Zeruiah? For you should be adversaries to me today. Shall any man be put to death today in Israel? For do I not know that today I am king over Israel?" Therefore, the king said to Shimei, "You shall not die." And the king swore to it. Now Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. And he had not cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he returned in peace. So it was, when he had come to Jerusalem to meet the king, that the king said to him, "Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth?" And he answered, "O Lord, O king, my servant deceived me, for your servant said, 'I will saddle a donkey for myself, that I may ride on it and go to the king, because your servant is lame.' And he has slandered your servant to my lord the king, but my lord the king is like the angel of God. Therefore, do what is good in your eyes. For all my father's house were but dead men before my lord the king. Yet you set your servant among those who eat at your own table. Therefore, what right have I still to cry out any more to the king?" So the king said to him, "Why do you speak any more of these matters? I have said, 'You and Ziba divide the land.'" Then Mephibosheth said to the king, "Rather, let me take it all, insomuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house." And Barzillai the Gileadite came down from Rogalim and went across the Jordan with the king to escort him across the Jordan. Now Barzillai was a very aged man, 80 years old, and he had provided the king with supplies while he stayed in Mahanaim, and he was a very rich man. The king said to Barzillai, "Come across with me, and I will provide you. I will provide for you while you are with me in Jerusalem." But Barzillai said to the king, "How long have I to live that I should come up with the king of Jerusalem? I am today 80 years old. Can I discern between the good and bad? Can your servant taste what I eat or what I drink? Can I hear any longer the voice of singing men and singing women? Why then should your servant be a further burden to my lord the king? Your servant will go a little way across the Jordan with the king. And why should the king repay me with such a reward? Please let your servant turn back again, that I may die in my own city, near the grave of my father and mother. But here is your servant Himaim. Let him cross over with the lord the king, and do for him what seems good to you." And the king answered, "Himaim shall cross over with me, and I will do for him what seems good to you. Now, whatever you request of me, I will do it for you." Then all the people went over the Jordan, and the king had crossed over. The king kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his own place. Now the king went on to Gilgal, and Hanaim went on with him. And all the people of Judah escorted the king, and also half the people of Israel. Just then all the people of Israel came to the king and said to the king, "Why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king, his household, and all David's men with him across the Jordan?" So all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, "Because the king is a close relative of ours. Why then are you angry over this matter? Have we ever eaten at the king's expense, or has he given us any gift?" And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, "We have 10 shares in the king. Therefore, we also have more right to David than you. Why then do you despise us? Were we not the first to advise in bringing back our king?" Yet the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel.
So that was 2 Samuel chapter 19, including the last tail end of the verse 33 of chapter 18. I did that way because my Bible's broken up in that fashion as opposed to some other breakups. But there's a lot of stuff in this chapter. I probably won't cover all today, but I'll cover what I can. Any questions or comments? Things, something that caught your attention that you'd have a curiosity about? But clearly, I know in previous chapters we've discussed, obviously, David's fleeing of Absalom, the battle that ensued, Absalom's death with the hanging in the tree and such. We have, obviously, David grieving over the death of his son, but Joab was the one who had killed Absalom, as well as his 10 armor-bearers. I won't give you an entire rundown, but that's basically kind of where we're at. And David, of course, is getting over the death of his son and has to be a king again and be a father and be the leader of his country in spite of his great personal loss. Of course, this chapter of 19 ensues, describing all those details and the reception and return of King David. After reading this chapter, has anything caught your attention regarding it? Some questions you had that you hadn't seen before? Me personally, I happen to have thought that the discussion between Judah and the Israelites was most interesting to me. Their argument as far as who had greater right to King David than the other. Hopefully we'll get a chance to get to that today. Well, if there are no direct questions, I'm going to go ahead and go through this. I pray it will be of interest to you. It was eye-opening for me after reading this chapter. Oh. Go ahead, David.
Selflessness. You know, how he could have gone over with the king, but he was realizing that, you know, he had lived his life. He was happy where he was at. He wanted to die where he was at. And then he gave that position to his, I guess, his servant.
Presumably son or servant. It doesn't say, who the guy was.
But even so, I thought it was a very noble thing. And even so with David, wanting to do still the right thing and still bring him over and give him that place, you know, David's heart in the matter as well.
That is a really important next lesson that you picked up on regarding Barzillai and his nephew, son, whatever, don't know what it was, servant. Because that's a major, major theme of the chapters, Barzillai, and what he did here. We will see that again in a much more profound way in Messiah's lifetime. This man's actions dictated a lot in the New Testament that we don't know about. Just this simple act, it actually changed our concept of God by what he did here today, or what we read today. our concept. Many people's concept of God. Everybody's concept. But it changed many, because it changed what Messiah did after he rose from the dead. Any other questions or comments? All right. Well, then I'm going to go ahead and begin. Now, naturally, of course, we've already discussed many times Absalom's death is a picture of Messiah's death. We discussed that in great detail, in numerous ways, in numerous fashions. And the report of Absalom's death to David, that's the whole, look at the one whose his feet is running with good news. Those of you who ever heard the song, Manavu, that's what it's about. It is the celebration of the mountains, the one that carries the feet of him who grieves good news. It's carrying Abishai, the good news of God. That's why we discussed in great detail a month plus ago, as I was last up here, the concept of what good news is and what it means. So David receives this good news, which unfortunately for David was great tragic news. Well, if you recall correctly, when Messiah dies, what was God's immediate reaction? Well, destruction. It was tragic. He was angry. He was upset. Well, that's what you would expect from a father. And that's what we get from David. It's the same reaction. But at the same time, Messiah's death and Absalom's death is a moment of salvation for everybody else. So we have this unique blend that God has pictured out for us, that salvation involves a tragic event of death. Well, that would make sense because we also know the first time salvation is defined for us in the Bible is with Egypt. And Moses tells me, look and watch the salvation of the Lord. And what happens? He parts the Red Sea and kills the Egyptians. So salvation to save you requires a mass death of something or someone else. Dangerous, scary, but beyond your personal control. Everything's beyond your personal control. So we have David's reaction similar to God's reaction, which is what we would expect since David at this point in the story is symbolically being God. He's acting like the king, the one who's in control of everything. His son, of course, was a usurper, which is a separate issue, blending both Messiah and sinner, or Satan, into one until he died. That was the whole point of the picture. So you have a Satan dying, also known as Messiah dying, to save David and all the people, which is exactly what happened. So in verse 3, they point out very plainly that verse 2, sorry, the king is grieved. Well, why verse 2? I think it's your verse 3. Well, whatever. The verse is a little different here. The king is grieved for his son. It has turned the day of salvation into a day of mourning. So his men literally stole back into the city as if they were shamed, like they lost. So they perceived that we've won, but that was a worse fate. Well, that's the feeling we should be getting when we think of Messiah's death. Yes, that was a great salvation for us, but it is a worse fate to have to have gone through that. That was a greater tragedy than the gain of it. It was a bizarre mix. That should be what our reaction should be like. But it also makes sense that you're going to have salvation mixed with mourning. The examples in the Bible are numerous. I'm going to list a few of them here, for example. Abraham and Isaac. What was Isaac's salvation? Well, that would be the ram that was stuck there on the side, right? Well, who was mourning? His father. So Isaac's salvation was a mix, and of course Isaac's mother dies, probably around the same time period, possibly due to grieving for the death of her son. We don't know for certain. His salvation is mixed with a great tragedy inside of his father. What father would not have that intense emotional drama of mourning for the impending death of your son at your own hand? So we have this idea of salvation and death mixed together. And of course, I mentioned the death of Egypt and, of course, the Red Sea. You also have the same thing with Cain and Abel. You have the salvation of Cain mixed with the great mourning of his loss of, not his brother, but of his at oneness with God. Salvation, Cain lived for however many, I don't know how old he was, doesn't record his age, but he lived past it. God allowed him to be saved, to continue on, but at a great loss of himself. He said, loss is too great for me to bear, is where Cain's words. This is too much. I cannot handle this. You also, of course, have Adam and Eve. Their disobedience, what was the salvation for them? Well, death is. Well, did they die? Yeah, 900 years later, who actually died initially? Whatever animal God made the skins out of. Their salvation required the death of something, which is the first time something died, which is also a great mourning tragedy. You see the death of an object, animal, whatever beast it was, it doesn't say. It's probably a lamb of some form or a goat, but we don't know for certain. And we see the death of it, and they are fully responsible for it. And they know that is the first time you see that you're responsible for killing something, that scars you, that marks you. You are now in a grieving state of mourning. Now, granted, nowadays, things die all the time. That's just normal life. But at that important time, it was not for them. They're the first instance of it. So you have these mixed in courses as well. They got saved, but it cost them. Not only that, they also got kicked out of Eden. In order to be saved, you must now leave. It was a mix of, this is too difficult for us to bear, but yet this is how our future life will be. So you have these mixes of these salvations and mourning and grieving at the same time. So I have a quick question for you. We are expecting a salvation of God still to come. Is it going to be mixed with mourning? A lot. Every example God gives us, it's mixed with mourning and grieving and death. So that's what you would expect. The greater the salvation, what happened? The greater the mourning and death was. So if you're expecting a greater salvation still to come, then expect a greater mourning to come. So that's a simple lesson we can learn, at least for the first few verses from this particular chapter. I'll talk about that. In verse 4 and 5, which is my verse 4 and 5, bear with me if yours is slightly different. As it points out, the king, of course, hid himself. And it says he wrapped his face, or he covered his face, my verse 5. I think it might be your verse 4, I'm not sure. And cried out in a loud voice, my son, Absalom, my son, my son. What do you think, or why do you think the king covered his face?
Pictures
of?
Messiah.
Picture of Messiah.
Turning
his face away.
Didn't
want to see it. That's fair. That's a fair example. Yeah, it took too long to spit it out. And that it's a picture of, this is too great for me, God, to witness. I will now not look at it. I will turn away. That is a fair example. I think that's a good example in many ways. What other examples are there of concealing one's face in your Bibles? God is the one who does it all the time. Almost every example, God is the one who's hiding his face or concealing his face. Moses is an example of one concealing his face. Why? What is the symbolism there? What's God trying to point out to us when he or somebody else conceals their face? And we're going to have to look at what the symbolism of concealing one's face is in the Middle Eastern culture to get a general idea of what God is actually pointing out in this story. Yes, Jeff.
Ichabod.
Ichabod.
The glory is departed.
Yeah, the glory is departed. Ichabod, yes. So what was that? He was the son, grandson of Eli, right? Ichabod? Yeah, glory is departed. God is dividing himself, separating away. You are not part of me. I do not wish to be seen by you. I do not wish to be part of you. You cannot be part of me. This is a moment of, I reject you. Which I find very fascinating that Moses had his face concealed. Because to me, when I see an example of someone concealing their face, it is a rejection of separation. Then Moses having his face concealed, the people themselves, the goal was to prevent them from being fearful. They were the ones who needed his face concealed. Yes, Temi?
They were rejecting him.
Exactly. They're rejecting him. Which would make sense. God is in mourning, or Moses, of course, symbolic of God at this point in time throughout the Torah. It was symbolic of God vice versa. That Moses was in mourning for God rejecting, for them rejecting God, or them rejecting him. It's the same thing. It's a point of, you of desiring not to be with me, thus I will conceal my face. In this instance, we have the same thing. It's the roles are switched. David's one concealing his face. But then again, think about it. If God's concealing his face from the face of the earth, which he did when Messiah died, for briefly, he still interacts with us, don't get me wrong. If he is in mourning, it's because the people didn't want him. Didn't want God. That's the same symbolism that Moses gets when he covers his face. The people don't want me. And God, the death of his son, the people don't want me. I will conceal my face. It discusses it many times. You're welcome to read it when you're looking up faces and how many times God discusses, they'll be cut off from the face of the earth. I will conceal my face from them. Over and over and over again, it is a sign of rejection, of did not desire to be with. It's a beautiful example of mourning. By the way, which I think is the contrast to it, which is the key to this whole face concealing thing, is that in Revelations, what does God say? They will see my face face to face. The mourning, the rejection, will actually be gone. Which is a great imagery of what we see when God's referring to the face. So how important is your face? How important is God's face? Apparently so important that he purposefully had to conceal it from us because we had to reject him. And he couldn't take it. It was unacceptable. Because he knew if he did take it, we'd all be dead. For rejecting him. For doing a sin. So it is a great, powerful example of what God is symbolically trying to tell us by simple actions. There's far more to this chapter than I'm going to get to today, but bear with me. Joab, in my verse 6, goes and confronts David. Verse 5 and 6, in your verse 5. He comes to the house and says, "Today you've disgraced all your servants. Today you've saved the life. Who have saved your life? The lives of your sons, your daughters, the lives of your wives, the lives of your concubines. In that you love your enemies. You love your enemies and hate your friends." The corrections that Joab is giving David, he's actually correcting him. You were incorrect in your reaction as far as Joab's concerned. Because though David is acting like God in the story, well, he also still is a man too. There is a storyline to follow here. And this important correction is there for us to also learn from. Because note, Joab points out, your men endangered their lives for you. And you rejected them. He notes that David has shown no regard for the children, sons and daughters, who didn't follow Absalom. Who are with David and fled with him. Who may have also died at Absalom's hand. Yes, Ellie?
God also has to be reminded not to throw us all away just because we were bad.
Exactly. That's the beauty of it. If you recall, there are times as Moses talks to God and talks him out of it. Hey, this is don't do this. That's too much. And God says, "Okay, fine. You do it. You deal with it." to control or restrain his own wrath. Is God always correct? Of course he's always correct. That's the point. And Moses is saying, "We know you're right, but can you give a little mercy just for a minute, and then we'll kind of move past this, and maybe you'll forget, not forget, but at least forgive and continue on," which is the goal, to ignore our sins or cover them over. And of course, David Job also points out, David shows no regard for his concubines and wives, who, of course, concubines were forced to be with Absalom, the 10 he left behind, and the wives that are also with him, who were not left behind. He showed no regard for any of the people who love him, whether his servants, whether his sons and daughters, or whether his wives. None of them. Because he grieved greater his loss of Absalom, his son, than any of them. In that, pointing out, your family, David, / God, is still here. Your family still needs you. So God's loss of his son, does God say, "Okay, I quit"? Well, heaven forbid. If he quits, we're all gone. This is planned out. Yes, it was a great grieving moment, but God still knows there's a job to be done. The people must now be reassured, be forgiven, raised back up. So, of course, David goes, he says, all right, yeah, bucks up, walks out there. It's okay, I'll sit at the city gate, which I am very well visible. All of Israel can see me. Those who are at Mount Anim, where David is living at this moment in time. And then, of course, they all say, hey, the king is there, sitting at the gate. And so all the people come. And what's the purpose of their coming? So for everyone who had fled to his tent, people see him at the gate. Your objective is to, when you see the king at the gate and you've done a service to him, at this point in time in history, you go up to the gate, make sure, if you can, the king sees your face and acknowledges that you are loyal to him. That's the purpose. That's the objective here. Loyalty is the main thrust of Barzillai, which David mentioned, and Shimei and Mephibosheth, their subsequent parts of this chapter. It's a testing of loyalty, which David needs to find out about. And all of you, of course, come and see yourself in front of David and say, yeah, David's here. He's all right. We're all good. In your verse 9, it points out that people were in dispute throughout all the tribes of Israel. Note, stop there for a second. This is one of the first times, not the only time, but one of the early times, where tribes of Israel and the tribes of Judah/Benjamin are now delineated. It's the first time in which the Israel's the northern tribes from Joseph, and Judah includes Benjamin of the southern tribe. This chapter is where that those separations become distinct and profound, accurate, prophetic. So the word of using it. So these are the northern tribes, by the way, discussing this issue with Judah, the southern tribes, saying, the northern tribes arguing, let's see, the king, referred to David, saved us from the hand of our enemies, delivered us from the hand of the Philistines, and we fled from the land of Absalom. Absalom, who we anointed over us, has died in battle. Now therefore, why do you say, who's you is Judah, say nothing about bringing back the king? So the northern 10 tribes are talking to Judah's leaders and saying, hey, why are you not willing to bring back the king? All of us are. You need to come forth. Which is prophetic. There's a reason why Judah is reluctant. They're supposed to be reluctant. King David goes to Zadok and Abiathar, the priest, in verse 11, and says, speak to the elders of Judah. Does he bother speaking to the elders of the rest of Israel? Well, no, they're already on his side. He already knows they all want him back. It's Judah that does not. Speak to Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, since the word of all of Israel have come to the king, even to his house? So all of Israel has sent message, all the different tribes have sent message to the king, we want you back, but Judah has not. Judah is holding back. They're the ones who don't want it. What does King David have to do? He points out, you are brethren, my bone and my flesh. Why did you last bring up the king? There's verse 12. Verse 13, he has to make a concession. Say to Amasa, which is the commander, are you not bone of my bone, flesh by flesh? God do so to me and more also if you do not become commander before my army continually in the place of Joab. And so then he, referring to Amasa in verse 14, swayed the hearts of all the men of Judah, just as the heart of one man. So the king had to convince Amasa, their remaining commander, the remaining leader, because note, Ahithophel committed suicide. Hushai was the spy on David's behalf. So neither of those two advisors are legitimate in the eyes of Judah. Amasa is the only person who has any power or control on anything, because he controls the military. So David makes a concession to Amasa. You will become over everything in front of or above Joab, who has been with David this time for about 30 plus years. As his commander of the army. Granted, Joab's getting a little bit older, but he's also roughly 10 to 20 years younger than David, so he's not quite so bad. David's about his mid-60s or so around this time. So, of course, return you and all your servants. Where came the king from Judah and Amasa? Return you and all your servants. The king returned, came to Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal to go to meet the king to escort the king across the Jordan. So, was David focused at all or concerned at all about the people who were already on his side? No. I have a question for you, which we'll get into greater detail shortly. Is God, Messiah's return more accurately speaking, the second time comes back, is his focus going to be upon those who are already on his side? No. Just like this, it's all prophesied. God's, Messiah's, objective is not to convince the people who are already convinced. So, as Christians, what are we expecting? Is God going to say, hey, Christians, yay, we all made it? He's saying, yeah, I expected you to. Judah, come here. And all of us know our place. We place second fiddle. Even Israel says, wait a minute, we were with him. We support him before you did, Judah. We have 10 times greater than you. At the end of the chapter, they argue this. And Judah says, he has given us no favor. He is our king. Back off. And they say, okay. Know our place. That's all I can tell you. If you get nothing else this chapter, know our place. We are not the all-hailing a parade that brings Jesus into the Messiah, into the promised land. That's not our place. Judah. That is Judah's place. They may hate it, they may dislike it, all the way up until that moment in time. When that moment in time comes, the only advice I can tell you all, back off. And accept the place where you belong. Note the parable of the prodigal son. That's not just a parable of interesting, oh look, he likes the people who finally came back to him and said, okay, yes, God, I'm so sorry. But what about the son who was always there? He's already on your side, ignore him. The one who rejected you, that's the one God wants. If you have 1,000 sheep and one runs off, you say, okay, 1,000 sheep, good, I'm glad you stayed. Sorry, little one. No, all sheep, you're already here, you're fine. You're safe. Get over it. I gotta go find the one. Know your place. I gotta know my place. We all know our place. It is second fiddle to God's ultimate primary objective. Judah has to come. Yes, Ellie.
Wouldn't that also, much to our human chagrin, hold true of whether one lives or dies? Because if we are safe in the bosom of Abraham, whether we technically live through or don't live through something is not a big issue. Now, if we have children, if we have responsibilities or something that God may preserve for that reason, but it's not like, okay, all of the good guys live through it, all the bad guys die. It's actually, like you said, the sheep to go get the one is mm-hmm. more important in that point in time.
Right. And I know we always have issues with the whole thought of, oh, what about my kids and as they're growing? Note, there are multiple times which enemies came against Israel and children died. Children of good men, good women, died, along with their parents. To fear death is natural. We expect that. To make it control your life is unwise. I may lose my kids. I don't know. Whatever, that's God's business. But I've got to know that's okay. We're just flesh and blood. It's not the end of everything. It's okay. So anyway, I wanted to point that out to you because it's very important to know our place. That it is not, we are not God's objective. We're already taken care of. It's the ones that God did not get, that did not accept. Those are the ones he needs to pull back and spend the time and the effort on. Whatever happens to us, we're okay whether we live or die. Well, what about Judah? Well, they're not okay if they die. They need to live a little while for them to say, okay, I submit my own pride and I will accept, which is what they have to do. We'll discuss the concession to Amasa later. Okay. That comes to more interesting parts, which I consider interesting, meaning prophetic. Shimei, Mephibosheth, and Barzillai. those of you who recall in verse 16, it says, Shammai, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, who was from Bahurim, hastened and came down with the men of Judah to meet the king David. There were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him. So note, Judah and Benjamin are both there greeting the king. Note, meaning they all came. Israel, they were there too, but it focuses those particular tribes were the ones that the king was waiting for. So, Shammai, do you recall who he was? He was a servant of Saul. When David was fleeing Amasa, Shammai grabbed rocks and threw at it, cursed at him, said, you horrible bloody man, you deserve all of this. God has put this upon you, you are going to die, you deserve what is happening to you. And Abiathar, David's the brother of Joab, said, can I kill this guy? And David said, why? Maybe I need this. Maybe I need some humility. Maybe God will hear what he's saying, have pity on me. Let him be. And so he kicks dust and throws rocks at him as he's trailing around and walking off and going on to the next town. So Shammai, is he an honest man? Maybe. At this point in time, his great sin that he says, oh, I'm so sorry, king. Maybe he not. Maybe not so much. He comes, of course, with Ziba. Note, Ziba, do you recall who Ziba was? He was Mephibosheth's servant who showed up to greet David as he was fleeing with 2 donkeys, with some provisions, not a whole lot, but a little bit of provisions on there, to declare his loyalty. And David said, where's Mephibosheth? And Ziba tells him, he wanted to become the next king. So he stayed home. He was, hey, great, you know, David's gone, I can be king. And David said, you know what? Everything Mephibosheth owns now is yours. And he left off. Now, we just read in this section, in this chapter, that as he comes back, Mephibosheth greets him. Not the first one to greet him, but he's a long way. And David says, where have you been? Another way of wording it. Where were you? How come you didn't come? He says, well, wait a minute. Ziba, I told him to go get my donkey. And the 2 of us on 2 donkeys would come greet you. And he left. He left me. It is funny that Ziba had 2 donkeys. So it could be. He didn't have 20, he had 2. It could be. Now, David, at that point, doesn't know. Now, granted, the Mephibosheth is not shaven. He is unkept. He did not take care of his feet. He didn't do anything of a kingly nature would ever want to be. While David was gone, it is a sign of grieving. So it implies the Mephibosheth was probably the one telling the truth, and Ziba probably wasn't so much. And the reason that you can gather that information, other than previously we already connected it into Hushai in the Chaisic structure, which means traitor, we connected into that earlier. He also shows up here with Shammai. Ziba and Shammai show up together. Shammai is the dishonest one who flips sides. Hey, I hate you. No, I love you. Get back and forth. Just depends on who's in charge. Well, Ziba shows up with him. It implies there may be some, again, unscrupulous information going on between the 2 of them, or at least with Ziba and his lifestyle. David, not knowing who was true, who was untrue, said, all right, you know what, I don't know, 50-50, just split it between both of you. You get half of each lamb. I'm not going to say who gets one or the other. Mephibosheth says, no, don't bother splitting it, just give it to him. I don't want it. I don't need it. Why does he not need it? He lives in the king's house. He, his sons, everything, they all live there. They're already in the king's home. What else do they possibly need? What's the land going to do them? They don't need it. It's no use for it. So it implies to me that Mephibosheth was probably the one telling the truth. There's more to these 2 and soon to be 3 men I'll get to in a moment. I have to talk about them first before I go back and tell you what they mean. Abishai, of course, goes to Shammai when Abishai comes to him and says, you know, please do not impute iniquity to your servant. I know I have sinned. Says, can I kill him now? And David still says, no. No one will be put to death in Israel. I will forgive all of their sins. No one put to death today, which is very important that we note why David is acting as the resurrected Messiah. He's forgiving of all sins. It says in verse 23, to Shammai, you shall not die. The king swore to me he wouldn't die. Now the next man comes. Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. He had not cared for his feet or turned his mushes, as I already mentioned before, washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came back. So it was, when he had come to Jerusalem to meet the king said to him, why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? He answered the king, my lord, servant deceived me, for I set aside a donkey for myself, that I may go ride on it, the king, but your servant is lame, and blah, blah, blah. We already discussed that. I'm not going to discuss this just yet, but I have to go back to it in about 2 minutes or less. Of course, he splits the between both of them. We already discussed this. In verse 31, Barzillai, the Gileadite, came down from Rogalim and went across Jordan with the king to escort him across the Jordan. I'm going to stop there for a moment. Where was the king when Shimei and Ziba meet him to greet him back? Where does it say he was at? This is the other side of Jordan, right? Where was he when Mephibosheth greets him? Right. Now, where is he when Barzillai greets him? On the Jordan. You don't, out of chronological order, you're at the Jordan, crossing, you're at Jerusalem, oh, you're back to the Jordan again. Doesn't it seem strange that it didn't take Mephibosheth and put him after Barzillai? The story, the sequence of events. How is it a man can come, Shimei, who was at the Jordan River, come and greet the king, and then Mephibosheth at Jerusalem greets him, and then Barzillai, the king, magically goes back to the Jordan to be greeted? No, Barzillai greets him at the Jordan too. It tells you, this is written out of order. It's done that way on purpose. It's not accidental. We could obviously say, oh, well, yeah, no, these are people greeting the king. Yeah, we'll shove them all in one story. That's a very, very superficial appearance of it. They're all greeting the king, that's true. They're all discussing with him, greeting him back to one extent to another. They're all, you know, basically just welcoming him home. What order does it go in? It doesn't really matter, right? No, actually, it very, very importantly matters. It was written this way for a reason. First of all, Mephibosheth, could he travel from Jerusalem to the Jordan River? No, of course not. He has lame feet. He has no donkey and a servant took off with them. He doesn't have many options. Now, could he have borrowed a donkey? Could he have convinced somebody else to help him without getting caught for being a David supporter and not an Absalom supporter? Maybe. Maybe he could have. Hard to say. Could he have had one of his sons go get a donkey? Probably. But he didn't. For whatever reasons, we don't know all the details, which is why I think David wasn't quite sure who was telling the truth. But David goes on a questioning hunt from Mephibosheth, doesn't he? He questions him. Where were you? Why didn't you come? And David, after saying, why do you speak to me any more manners? Have I said, you and Ziba just divide it. I don't want to talk about it anymore. We don't have to discuss this in any detail. And verse 29. And of course, Mephibosheth responds, please don't. We'll just let Ziba have it all. That's very, very important, because these three men are symbolic of a particular individual in Messiah's life. Barzillai, the Gileadite, showed support for David from the day one onward. Barzillai was the one who, when David was fleeing, they were out of food, out of money, out of everything you possibly could imagine that they were out of, fleeing from Absalom. Barzillai comes at shortly when the time in which corresponds to Messiah's, you know, needing help with the cross thing and lifting up there, or the stake, we would call it, and needing help for assistance. Barzillai was that person for David. Brought him not only donkeys, but abundance of food for all of his men and all of their families. And it says it invigorated David. And from that moment, you can see in the storyline of David, he became former king to the powerhouse who turned around and kill everybody for doing this. He flipped him. Barzillai's assistance. Perfect timing for him. Barzillai, of course, comes to David and to escort him across. He's 80-year-old man. And an interesting conversation happens between the two of them. I say it's interesting because it's not a normal conversation you would have with someone who is 80. Especially an 80-year-old man who's very wealthy and obviously very good at what he does. He discusses he's no longer discerning. He's not wise. How many 80-year-old men who are very good, very talented, very wealthy, consider themselves unfit, unwise, of no use, just wish to go home and die? Is he sickly? Well, no. He traveled from Gilead all the way down to the Jordan River, the crossing of Gilgal. That's not an easy feat when you're old, no matter what time of year it is. It's an odd conversation, but the conversation is not written there for Barzillai's sake. It's written there for Peter's, which we'll discuss Peter in a moment. Barzillai, of course, says, no, take Chaim, son, daughter, servant, whatever. He was some relative or some association with Barzillai. And, of course, Chimham, I pronounce it correctly, sorry for his butchering his name, the king, of course, imparts to him all the benefits that he would have gotten to Barzillai. And Barzillai, of course, goes home. He wants to set his house in order that he may die in peace in his own home where his father and his mother are buried. And then, of course, you have arguing between Judah and Israel shortly thereafter, which I already discussed, the argument between Judah and Israel. That's the whole know your place. Yes, you may have been much further, longer a supporter of the Son of God in your own personal belief, in your own life. It is no relevance to what God's objective here is when he comes back to discuss and get Judah. So, these three men, the key to all three of them is written in John, Book of John, chapter 20 and 21. I have written up on my board, it says, who is Shammai, Mephibosheth, and Barzillai in Messiah's life? Who are these men? This is prophetic, right? They're supposed to be, we should be able to see and identify who's who in the story of David with Absalom in Messiah's life. The main characters, match. We all know who they are. We've matched Messiah. We've matched, actually a number of different ways, matched Messiah. We matched God, quite clearly. We matched Shammai earlier. We matched Abiathar earlier to Peter, with the whole cut off his ear, cut off his head connection there. With the one who is confronting him. We've matched Hushai with Ahithophel with Judas Iscariot. There's a number of characters, the main characters, who we matched. So why? Who are these men? Quite a bit of scripture was dedicated to them. Who are they in this part of the story? Well, your key is going to be, like I said, in John 20 and 21. First of all, Shammai do? He cursed David. He threw stuff at him. And then he repented, realized, I'm sin, I'm so sorry. Who does that initially remind you of? Did Paul curse God? To some extent he did, that's true, but wrong timing. Messiah, in this story, when he's coming back as David, and people are greeting him, oh, he is the king, he's be the resurrected Messiah. Paul doesn't believe that for years. So it doesn't quite match Paul, the timing is off. Who else cursed Messiah while he was being arrested, and then blessed Messiah when he was not? That would be Peter. That would be Peter. Oh, it's a different color. Now, this is an interesting part, which I think is beautiful, a Messiah's discussion of Peter being, as we've discussed many times in the past, the whole son of Satan, son of God, and a mixed thing, funny thing going on here. Shammai, who wanted him dead? Who wanted to kill him? Abiathar did. The son of Zeruiah, when he was first taking off from Absalom. He said, let me cut off his head. Now, we connected him to Peter's desire to cut off the one who's confronting him, his ear. We matched them. And David said to Abiathar, back off. This is not appropriate. Messiah says to Peter, get behind me. This is inappropriate. You don't do this. And they fixed it. One saved Shammai's life, then we'll put his ear back on. So Peter was at Abiathar while he was being arrested. While Messiah was being arrested. Then he became Shammai when he was cursing Messiah. So I find it funny. Abiathar slash Peter wanted to kill Shammai slash Peter. Funny, isn't it? You actually have a funny parallelism between Shammai being Peter at the same time Abiathar is being Peter. Abiathar is trying to kill Shammai, so Peter is trying to kill Peter. I think that's just brilliantly funny. So Shammai being Peter cursed him. Then when Messiah was no longer, when he was dead and came back, Peter said, I love you. I'm so sorry. I love you. I really do. And he had to ask him three times, testing his loyalty. Yes, Jeff.
It was almost as if Peter was being sifted like wheat.
Yes, almost like being sifted like wheat. Brilliant, because he's being picked out, the part of him that's good and the part of him that's bad. Mephibosheth, this is what is brilliant about God's, what he did this story. When he wrote Mephibosheth, what did Messiah do when he came back, when he's confronted Peter? And Peter both rejected him and not rejected him. What did Messiah do? He asked him a bunch of questions. He tests his loyalty. Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? Over and over and over again. Well, what's David doing here to Mephibosheth? Where were you? Where were you? Where were you? Do I believe you or not? Are you really loyal to me? So it's funny, Mephibosheth and Peter are still the same man. So we have Peter is the one being inquired, or the inquiry is happening. He's being the one being tested. So we have both in the David story, Shammai and Mephibosheth both being reflected in different aspects, along with Abiathar, the son of Zeruiah, the one who wanted to kill their, chop their head off. They're all the same man, all inside of Peter. But there's more. Barzillai. So what about Barzillai? He was dedicated to Messiah all the way through, dedicated to David, slash Messiah, I'm using one interchangeably. He was always his friend. He helped him as best he possibly could. The only thing about Barzillai is that he had no discerning ability left. Couldn't see or hear. Well, that's funny, because if you recall in John 20 and 21, which you're welcome to read yourself if you wish, it's not that hard. What happened to the disciples when Messiah was dead? They fell apart. The men who were most in tune, most well-educated, most instructed, should be the smartest people there are regarding Messiah, what they do? They have no discernment. They have no truth in them at that moment in time. But that's not quite enough. Oops. The table's bigger. Oh. The last time I was here, the table's bigger. Yes. But that's just a little bit. What did David and Barzillai talk about? Okay, so I have no discerning. I'm too old. I don't go with me. Give my benefit to someone else. Go home and die. Now, what did David, or sorry, what did Messiah tell Peter? Verse chapter 21, we're going to jump straight to, well, we'll just read verse 15 onward for a little while. So when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these? This, of course, is an inquiry regarding Mephibosheth, same principle. He said to you, yes, Lord, you know I love you. He said to him, feed my lambs. They said to him again a second time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said, tend my sheep. Then he said to him third time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? Peter was grieved because he had said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my sheep. Most assuredly I say to you, when you were younger, you girded yourself and you walked where you wished. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish. Stop. He doesn't get to go home and die. Barzillai gets to go home and die. Why? He was dedicated to David from the beginning all the way through. What was Peter's fault? Where was his shortcoming? He was not consistently with, always dedicated to Messiah throughout his life, even when it got difficult. He wasn't there. So what's Peter's fate? You will not get the benefit of Barzillai. You will not be wise. You will not live your life and die where you please. You will die where you do not please. You will go where you do not wish to go. You will be punished in that fashion. So again, who is Barzillai? Peter. You know, I'd say Peter was pretty important. His own life was prophesied 800, 900 years before he was born. Even his own personal issues within inside himself, the struggles he was have, are prophesied 800 years before he was born. Peter was important. I find that beautifully amazing. That God spent the time not only to tell us about Messiah and his life, but spent the time to tell us about his disciples too. In particular, one. Now, what I did not speak of just yet, which I would have mentioned just now as I conclude, Barzillai's blessings that Peter should have received, did Barzillai receive them from David? No. Chimham did. Well, that's funny. You know, there's something odd here after verse 20. Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following, who had also leaned on his breast the supper, and said, Lord, who is the one who betrays you? And Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, but Lord, what about this man, referring to this individual? Jesus said, if I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? Follow me. The blessing of love was not granted to Peter. Is granted to this man. Not Peter. So, Barzillai's blessing was granted to Chimham, not him. Isn't that funny? Chimham received what David said, everything that was going to be given to you, I will bestow upon this man. In your place. This blessing of the one whom Jesus loved was to John and not Peter. Why? Because Peter was not consistently with Messiah. It's a beautiful prophecy to my mind. God's very good when it comes to writing stories. Yes, Ellie, you had a comment?
It's almost like Peter had the choice of which part to play.
And both parts needed to be played. He chose the one that was, well, he chose, that's a harsh thing to say.
He lived out.
Right, he lived it out. He lived it out. Any questions or comments? Yes, Pierre Ann.
I always understood that the Greek asking Peter, do you love me, were three different words for love.
Yes, they are.
So does that bear any relevance to this story?
Personally speaking, yes, I think it does. Was Shimei's love the same style as Mephibosheth's love? Was it the same as Barzillai's love? No, they weren't. Shimei's was opportunistic. Insincere, but on the surface, it seemed right. Mephibosheth was as you would love a brother or a father. Barzillai's love is as you truly love a man. Not like a, you know, sexually, not, it's not a sexual thing, but you know, as far as love somebody, that what is mine is yours, what is yours is mine. I think there are three different aspects of people who are professing their loyalty / love to David. The same thing that Messiah is asking Peter. He's testing his loyalty slash love. Because when you love someone, you're loyal to them. They're one and the same as far as that's concerned, in particular when a king is in the presence. So he's testing the same exact fashion these three men were being exampled or shown to us. So yes, I think that is very important that it's an aspect of it, and that it reflects the characters of the men that they're confronting David. Oh, thoroughly, because we only have one word for it. Okay. Right, it's like, okay, what, you really not like him? Right, exactly. Yeah. Full hearing aids? Yeah. Any other questions or comments? I ended 10 minutes later than I expected, but oh well. God bless you with a wonderful... Oh, I'm sorry, did I miss anything? Oh, I already talked about the Israel and Judah saying butting heads.
Okay, yeah.
You know your place and end of it. I jumped to that earlier because it shows up twice. Sorry about that. No, that was the butting heads between Judah and Israel. Because one is the one who actually is responsible for the Messiah. Right. I wrote it down there. Know your place. And then that was about the balance of that story. Exactly, that's the point. Well, and the best part is that a Messiah, when he died and was resurrected, who didn't accept him?
I said that Judah was more harsh.
Right. They're tougher. They're tougher. But who didn't accept Messiah when he was born and when he died and resurrected again? Judah didn't. Where did all the disciples be sent off to? Doesn't. You're right. Exactly. You can say it doesn't. It's very important. It doesn't yet. They were sent off to every other Israelite their tribe there was. And what happened? It blossomed and grew. All the other 10 tribes, if I use that term very loosely, accepted and received. The one didn't.
So I'm curious, the email that Ellen sent about who's turning to accept Messiah now, are they going to be part of the 10? Okay.
Is that not true?
Urban legend.
Urban legend about Jews returning to Messiah?
Avi ben Mordecai sent out a note yesterday saying, wait a minute, take a look at this. And he researched it. There is no synagogue that event could have taken place because of the number of people involved. The Abraham guy does not exist, although there was one a couple of hundred years ago that was similar. He's saying somebody made this up, and it could have been, it was patterned after a dream that had happened a couple of hundred years ago, and the only people he could think that would have were the name of the Bible that was the translation that was mentioned. And he says, I don't know if that came from those guys. They don't know where it came from. It has gone viral. I have gotten 4 more emails with it. And I checked Avi ben Mordecai's first, thankfully, and I sent that on to other people who are sending it on. It's a non-story. When Avi called several Chabad and other groups, they said, Avi, what have you been drinking?
Fortunately, I have not read such an email. I don't check my email often. but no, I think it is very prophetic that Judah at the time did accept him, and that's what God's supposed to be waiting for and trying to get back at when he comes back. Amasa, which I mentioned, mentioned a little bit, but the next chapter he's killed in, so it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. But the concession that happens in order for them to accept Messiah, it's a bizarre concession, and I don't have a good picture of it. I have a partial picture, which I won't talk about now because it's not a good enough picture to explain. After he dies, it makes a little bit more sense. But we'll talk about Amasa and the concession he made, hopefully, next time. God bless the balance of your Shabbat and be with you.